Accession number 27185, reel 56. Correction, reel 55.
Major Barras, reel 55. You were saying that you had to leave, you planned to leave the platoon at the airfield.
Yes, that's right.
Did you actually go run, look at these schools on the ground?
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, I had to. Yeah, and I plotted them on a map, which I was hoping no one would discover.
Was the plan simply to occupy Georgetown, or did you have ideas about going beyond?
No, it was just Georgetown.
Georgetown and the Atkinson Field.
Yeah, there's not much else in British Guiana, actually. Outside, I mean, there's bauxite mines down the Demerara River, which, in fact, I was taken to on one occasion when I was there. Mm. but there's a lot of minerals at the back end of British Guiana. And there are a lot of villages, but there are, as far as I can remember, there are no other big towns around the place. The main centre of activity was Georgetown. And it had a cathedral. I remember it had a big wooden cathedral. It was a huge building, all made of wood. In fact, I think it's the only wooden cathedral in the world. But so far as going anywhere, apart from the airport was 15 miles outside, and apart from that, and Georgetown itself, I suppose if there'd been real trouble in the mining areas, we would have had to have sent troops out there, or the police might have tried to put it down themselves, supported by us. Obviously, we didn't want to employ soldiers shooting civilians, or have them out on the street being regarded as the enemy, so to speak. It was far better on all occasions if the locals could look after things themselves, which they were always encouraged to do.
Were the police armed?
No, I don't think so. Whether they had access to arms, I suspect they probably did. One or two of them probably did. No, they wouldn't have been armed.
What about the volunteers? What sort of numbers of them were there, and what was their...
I really can't remember. I suppose they were about company strength, I think, no more than that. Mm. But they were very enthusiastic and very loyal. I don't think they... I think they were all Guyanese. I don't think there were any British people involved at all. Their officers were Guyanese, and everybody else was.
When you went round to the schools, were you going round on your own, or were you conducted by members of the volunteer?
Well, I didn't get much. I didn't contact the volunteers after this, because it'd obviously been, if anybody had seen me doing it, it wouldn't have been a good move at all.
Yes.
I kept myself as far as I could near to Art and used his facilities. I think on one occasion the police helped me out. But I kept well away from the volunteers. But I didn't go into the schools. I mean, it was obviously wrong for me to start walking around. I mean, I got the information that I wanted. If there's any information which was required, the police could always get it for me and tell me what the capacity of the schools were and so forth. They could get this information without appearing to giving anything away.
Do you remember the commissioner of police telling you anything of any particular interest when you saw him?
Well, it was all of interest, I suppose. I can't think of anything outstanding. I remember the night before I was due to leave, he said, "I'd like you to come and talk to some people." So I said, "All right." And when it was dark, I did everything in the dark in those days. I was taken to a building, and then upstairs I was ushered into a long room, dimly lit, I suppose there must have been about 20 or 30 people all sitting round a long table in this dimly lit room, and I couldn't see really who they were. And they were expecting me to tell them all what the plan was.
Do you remember who they were?
Well, they were sort of local, I don't know, planters and officials of some sort or other. They were the sort of the European or the Brits expats, the senior expats from, there was a booker's store there, a huge departmental store, I suppose the owner was there. Anybody who would be, who he thought needed to know, but I didn't. So I'm afraid I disappointed them because I couldn't tell who these people were. And if I'd told them what was going to happen, and one of them had gone into the bar and had a few drinks and started talking, the whole thing would have been out before we got there. So I'm afraid I disappointed them. I didn't say very much.
What was the road network like in the country?
I didn't use the roads very much there. I mean, we either went by air or river.
But when you went from Atkinson to Georgetown, it seemed that was on road.
Yes. I can't remember, really. I think that road would probably have been okay because there was a lot of traffic went between the airport. I don't imagine that there were sort of motorways all over the place or tarmacked roads, because there wasn't an awful lot of traffic moving between these places.
Did you detect any sense of racial tension in Georgetown?
No,
when you were
visiting? I didn't, none at all. It was absolutely peaceful, quite peaceful. And this was the trouble, of course. You didn't know what was the moles were doing underground all the time, which could suddenly explode out without anybody realising it was coming, and that was why it was anticipated. So anyway, the next morning, Paul Barlow flew out of British Guiana, never to be seen again.
How long had you been in the country?
I can't remember now, 2 or 3 days. More than that maybe, because it took some time to get around. And by the time I got back to Jamaica, Sheffield was already alongside the oiling jetty of Trinidad Leaseholds, which was outside Kingston. And the two frigates, I think, had arrived actually in the harbour in Kingston. Now, these were obviously attracting attention. And a cover plan was that we were going to mount a it was an exercise, amphibious exercise, and troops were being boarded and were taken out. We were going to do a landing somewhere in Jamaica.
Where were you going to find your battalion group? Who was going to provide that?
Royal Welsh Fusiliers.
Didn't they have a company group in...
Yes, they had. It was less the company, less their company in British Honduras. It was also less a skeleton staff, which they had to leave behind for security purposes and sort of keep administration going. It was less the sick. It was less those who were due for mobilisation. It was less those who were due to go on courses or away on courses. So we finished up with 3 rifle companies.
Yes.
And I think they made up another company out of S Company and some of the headquarters company staff.
Had you considered using the Jamaica Battalion?
No, not outside Jamaica. That would have been, politically, wrong to expect Jamaicans to go and into British Guiana at that time, because they were the Jamaica Battalion. If they'd been the British West Indies Regiment, that might have been different.
Yes.
So it had to be the Royal Welsh, outside Jamaica, it had to be the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. So I got back. I didn't have time to issue any instructions and orders about what happened when we got to British Guiana, because we were due almost to sail within the next day or so. So we loaded on the in Sheffield. We had the brigadier and his tack headquarters and myself. We had a number of troops. I don't know how they were all allocated now, but of course the frigates weren't troop ships, so they had a limitation of numbers of troops they could take for this fairly long voyage it was going to be. It took 4 or 5 days at least to get down there. So the idea was that we would put as many in the frigate that they could hold without discomfort. The rest would go in Sheffield. And then when we got off Trinidad, they would then transfer those in Sheffield back into the frigates to join their companies, so that the last bit between there and Georgetown, they would be packed and very hot and uncomfortable. But that was the only way of doing it, because Sheffield could not go into British Guiana because of a sandbank 11 miles outside. So the nearest Sheffield could get to British Guiana was 11 miles. So when they got to Trinidad, this is the idea, that they would put all the troops out into the two frigates and just leave TAC headquarters, Brig and myself, and then a launch boat was going to come out to collect us when we got there. And then, of course, there was a company which was going by air, which we'd chartered, three British West Indian Airways Vikings, I think they were in those days, to carry them.
What was in the TAC headquarters?
About three or four of us, that's all. It was myself and the brig and a radio operator, probably, but runner, probably a couple of batmen or something like that, that's all. So that when we got ashore, we would be together. So we eventually set sail, having got everybody aboard. And of course, the aircraft were going to come later, the three aircraft, because they could do the journey in a day. We set out, and I was put into the Admiral's flat at the back. They gave me an office there, what they called the Admiral's flat. And I sat in there most of the time writing out orders. The Brigadier and the Admiral were up on the bridge. And now and again, I got sort of Tannoy would tell me to go up on the bridge. And I had to fight my way all the way down the ship, up long sort of gangways and ladders and God knows what, to get up there. Find out what they wanted, and then go back and do it, and then go back up there again. And I spent a lot of time moving around in the ship. So anyway, I sat in there for a bit, and then I think we got halfway there, and I was sent for again, and I was told the governor was getting very edgy, because BUP, the British United Press, had got wind of this and had published in the, I think it was the Daily Express, that troops were on their way to British Guiana.
Had you met the governor on your reconnaissance?
I'd met him before, but not on reconnaissance, no. I had met him before.
Mm. Was he the sort of man who'd get edgy without due cause?
He didn't give me that impression. But I think he got edgy because the gaff had been blown. Anyway, he sent a signal to the Admiral saying, please come as fast as you can. Mm. Well, of course, in those days, ships were only allowed to, well, I suppose they still are, allowed to go at what's called economic speed, so they didn't use more oil than they had to. So he had to get permission from the Admiralty to go at full speed. So he got this permission, and I was sitting in my office, and then door opened, the map day put his head in and said, in 10 minutes we're going up to full speed. And I said, thanks very much, and didn't take much more notice and sat down and started writing away. 10 minutes later, it was like being in a speedboat, but the back suddenly went down and it really sort of started to move forward. And of course, in those days, or I suppose now still, you put scuttles out of the portholes to catch the air coming in. And what it did was to catch about 3 or 4 tons of water, all came through the porthole, and drenched the whole place. All my workers swamped off the desk and onto the floor. And of course, the sailor didn't explain to me why he told me we were going up to full speed. He just went round telling her, and everybody else had got their scuttles in, closed their portholes, and get it carried on. Being a pongo, though, I suppose he thought it was probably I won't tell him. I don't know.
I'm using as a joke.
Yes, that's right. A silly old pongo. So, anyway, I got drenched, but I learnt my lesson from that one. Anyway, we were now going at full speed, and I don't know how many knots we made, but I went out. Now, when I was called up to the bridge, I really had to fight my way up there because it was a wind. The wind coming down the ship was incredible. We were going at, I suppose, nearly 30 knots. And it took me some time to fight my way up to the bridge again. You know, that's a rise of, what's it this time? Do you mind not calling me up here? Yes, it's absolutely necessary. Well, I didn't say that, but I sort of felt that. Mm. So anyway, we were going, and I looked at the other ships. I mean, we were overtaking all the commercial ships. We must have been going at quite a speed. And I don't know what they looked over and saw this warship dashing through the water, what they thought we were doing. Anyway, we eventually arrived at Trinidad. The transfers of troops took place off Trinidad at night, this was. In the meanwhile, the air element was probably boarding about this time, and they were going to have to refuel on the way down. And it had been organised that they would do it either at one of the Dutch colonies, either Aruba or Curaçao, I can't remember which one. I think it was Aruba. And the Dutch agreed to it, provided the troops didn't leave the aircraft. So that was arranged, and we eventually arrived off Georgetown at the dead of night. Engines were more or less turned off, as far as I can remember, and the brig and I stood on deck. Well, you couldn't see Georgetown; it was just over the horizon. So
were you still on the cruiser?
Yes, we were still on the cruiser. And we couldn't see Georgetown, and they couldn't see us when the daylight came, so they weren't aware of the sort of the size of the operation. Mm. So anyway, we waited for the launch to come out, the brig and I. And I can remember standing there on this balmy sort of tropical night with the water lapping up against the side of the cruiser. She was sort of slowly, I suppose she didn't drop anchor or anything, and you can't stand still out there, so I suspect it was just moving slightly. Waited and waited, and then eventually we heard the puttering of this launch getting nearer, and it came alongside, and the commissioner of police was there, and he looked right up at it, because it looked right down, it was miles down from where we were, and they threw a rope ladder down the side of the ship. Now the launch, there was quite a swell on, and the launch was going up and down like this, the side of the ship. And the brigadier said, right, I'll go first. So I thought, okay. So he went down, quite some way down. He gradually got down. He got down there. And just as he was putting his foot on the launch, it dropped. And he ended up spread eagle on the face down on the top of the launch, holding on so he didn't fall off in a rather undignified way. But, of course, there were lights. The ship had got lights on, all shining down the ladder and onto the launch all the way down. And the ships, all the crew had come out to see what was going on, have a little bit of entertainment. And I don't think their wildest dreams that they were ever going to look down there and see a sort of senior pongo sort of lying flat on his face on the top of a launch. Anyway, the old brig picked himself up and I was next one down. Unfortunately, the rest of us managed to to time it a bit better, having seen what had happened. There was a commissioner of police inside the launch, so we were taken back to Georgetown.
Do you remember what he told you?
No.
What was going on?
No, not very much. Mm. He said his orders were to take us straight to King's House, to Government House, as it was. So it took us some time. It's 11 miles out, so we arrived. By the time we got to Georgetown. We disembarked, not actually in the main dock there, we went down the side, I think, near Old Arts Ramp, I think it was. Yeah. And there was a Governor's Rolls Royce was waiting for us. And we all piled in and rushed off to Government House, expecting everybody to say, oh, thank God you've come, and that sort of thing. We got inside. Where's the Governor? Oh, he's shaving at the moment. So we'll come into the committee room. So we went into a committee room, sat around this big, shiny oak table there. And there was one or two others from the European governor's staff there. And we waited, and nobody seemed at all worried. I think they were, once we got the troops in, they just all sat back a bit. So anyway, we waited, and the governor came in. And the whole idea was that when we got there, Jagan and the rest of them were all going to be put in prison. They were going to be rounded up and put away.
How many people together were you going to arrest?
Well, the names of them are in that report thing, which I show, this one here. Mm. They give the names of about half a dozen, including Jagan's wife. Mm. She's implicated. I can't see them here. Anyway, they are here. They're all named. There are about half a dozen of them who were... Somebody called Wesley was there as well, who were implicated in undermining undermining operation. Anyway, we all sat round the table, and I can't remember who it was, but the legal advisor there got a big book in front of him, and he was turning over pages, and he said... And we said, well, when are you going to round up Jagan and put him inside? And he said, well, we can't. He said, we can't do it. It won't be legal. So they remained free. But as we'd all arrived, they didn't... I think they took they kept a low profile because we didn't come across any of them when I was there. So, anyway, the frigates arrived, the aircraft arrived, everything went according to plan, everybody went off to where they were supposed to go.
How did they move? Were they going by vehicle or on foot?
No, on foot, from where they were. It wasn't very far, just inside the city.
So they were just marching in column of foot?
Yeah, the transport was required from the airport to bring them in.
Yes.
Leaving the platoon behind.
How was that done? Was that requisitioned civilian?
That was done by the police under the... You know, we asked them to provide the transport for it, and they organised it. And then, at my suggestion, in order that the local population should see that something rather out of the ordinary had happened, that the three Dakotas... No, weren't Dakotas, they were Viking, I think, Viking aircraft, should fly over British Guiana in arrowhead formation. which they did. Little proud. The pilots of the aircraft thought this was a great gap. So they all
got. I suppose airliners often do fall.
No, not a bit. No. So they did it with great. I remember seeing them. Now I can still see them flying over, and everybody looking up and wondering what was going on. But at least it showed the people in the city that there was something happening, which they hadn't caught sight of the troops or whatever. So there we were. We took up our positions. I can't remember where we had our headquarters now. All the old planters went back to their clubs, and everybody carried on as if nothing had happened. They all relaxed, and troops are here, so we're safe. And
what did the troops actually do once they got into their bases?
I think we did a bit of patrolling, but there was nothing very much initially. There was nothing very much they could do.
Mm. Was this hard patrolling, or was it?
No, it was just a couple of sentries walking around down the streets just to show that they were there,
showing the flag.
Yeah, but the idea was that they wouldn't stay there long. And they wouldn't be in the schools long, because at some stage the schools were wanted back again. So alternative arrangements, after I'd left anyway, had to be made for the deployment of the battalion.
Had the companies done any training in riot drills or aid to the civil power?
Oh, they'd done that. Yes, they had. Yes.
Did they have any particular equipment for coping with civil commotion?
I don't think so. I mean, usually they don't need it, really. The magistrate is the guy who goes out with them with a loudspeaker and with a bugler, say, to draw the attention, and then to, with a loudspeaker, to say that if you don't stop and leave and go, we're going to fire. But it was all in the hands of the magistrate, unless it got so bad that the magistrate then handed over to the senior officer and said, right, it's up to you now. But it was a big responsibility, because if you start firing and kill somebody, it can cause more trouble than it's worth. But no, I don't think they had any special... of course, the immediately the Royal Welsh got there, the Prime Minister made arrangements for the first Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders to come out to relieve them. And they were sent out in their aircraft carrier, Indomitable, I think it was.
Did they turn up in Jamaica then?
No, they went straight to British Guiana.
British Guiana.
Yeah. And the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were wanted back in Jamaica as soon as possible, because the Queen was coming in November. Okay. So we weren't far away from our next next big deal. Mm. However, whilst we were in British Guiana, whilst we were in Georgetown, there was a rumour going on that there was gun running over the borders from Brazil into British Guiana, with a view which was thought it might have been Jagan trying to get some arms in. So it was decided that I and the governor's secretary, who I got to know very well now, we were working together. As I said, he's not just, he was executive secretary and handled a lot of the governor's stuff. We'd go over into Brazil and talk to the chief of police in a place called Boa Vista, which was the nearest Brazilian town, which you could only get to by air or by river. Had no roads. So he and I, Art Williams, used to make regular trips over the border to Boa Vista, and this, we found out, was one of his ramps, because old Art used to fill his aircraft with all kinds of things which he could sell over in Brazil. So when we got into the aircraft, and this was a Dakota DC-3, there was only a small portion of it partitioned off. There was a partition between the rest of where we were sitting and the rest of the aircraft. And there were about three or four other people in there, and we sat opposite each other on sort of bench-like seats, strapped in. And it occurred to me, where's the rest of the aeroplane gone? And I was told by the CIO, he said, that's full of radio sets and scotch and stuff which Art is smuggling out to sell over the other side. Everybody knew what he was up to. I mean, the funniest joke I heard there was from the secretary, that he was such a garrulous man that when the governor refused to give him a license, apparently, to operate to some particular point he wanted to go to with his aircraft in British Guiana, he got his own back by getting into the noisiest little aircraft he had. And on Sunday afternoon, when the governor was taking his siesta, as everybody would in those places, he climbed into it, flew up over the government house, and put on the noisiest noise he could make, and went backwards and forwards over government house on a Sunday afternoon whilst the governor was trying to get his kip. That was the sort of chap he was. Anyway, we took off. We lumbered down the grass. I can remember this. It was loaded to the gunnels. We lumbered off down the runway and just groaned off the ground and skimmed the palm trees at the end of the runway, and then went on groaning up into the sky. And it was quite some way, actually. And as we got up to our cruising level eventually, and the engines throttled back, Art sent a message back for me to come up to the flight deck. So I went up to the flight deck, and I was standing behind Art. And I hadn't realised before. I got a sight of looking through the back of his glasses. And it was like looking through the bottom of a beer bottle. They were so thick. I wondered if he could see anything at all.
Was he flying the aeroplane?
He was flying the aeroplane. And next to him was his number one. And as I was standing there, I saw his number one hand go out and start sort of hovering uncertainly over some of the buttons and instruments there. And Art suddenly saw it and went...